The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
New book has come out on the murder of Sophie Tuscon de Plantier. Sophie, the final verdict. And we're joined by the journalist Senan Maloney, who has written it. Senan, thank you very much. If Ian Bailey hadn't died, would this book be out?
Probably not, Matt, actually. Yeah, probably not, because of the skill with which he patrolled the outer reaches of his web of lies, as I call it. He was a trained lawyer, and he was a very litigious man, as you know. He took actions against 8 newspapers, which he comprehensively lost, 2 minor issues notwithstanding. He also took a case against the state, and there were negotiations underway to settle it for millions of euro that would have been saddled on the taxpayer.
Sorry, he would have received a payment.
It was a case for damages against the state.
For what?
For false imprisonment was the, you know, and, you know, the wrecking of his life through false accusation. That was his contention.
And the state was preparing to settle?
Well, negotiations were entered. It's a no-fault thing, you know, it's a preliminary, it's an outlining. The sides feed each other out, as you know. It happens every day of the week in the round court of the Courts of Justice and Central Criminal Court. Happens all the time. There were definitely discussions about what it would take to settle the case, but Bailey went on to fight it and lose it.
Now, and this isn't a spoiler to say you believe that he killed him. That's what the book is about, is you set out what you believe to be the evidence.
Exactly.
But
exactly
then, so why wasn't the DPP able to bring forward a case that would have settled this in the courts and have brought about a life sentence in prison for him?
Right. Well, I think you touched on absolutely the key element of this. Let's sweep away Ian Bailey, you know, much to his chagrin, to one side for a moment, because he just loved making this the Ian Bailey case over and over again. He kept waggling his fingers in the wounds of a dead woman. This woman came over. She'd had a wonderful time with a family in Dublin as a teenager on an exchange program. She fell in love with Ireland on their holidays. She bought herself an escape. And she came over with a bunch of scripts over Christmas, and she should have been left alone.
This is back in 1996.
Exactly, December of 1996. So we had this young mother, beautiful woman, who essentially had her head obliterated above the neck, and the state of Ireland failed to charge anybody for it. This is not some mass miscarriage of justice, as Ian Bailey would. There was no carriage of justice. That's the actual scandal in the matter. To get to the DPP, look, I mean, you could argue tendential, tiny legal points till the cows come home. I would make the contention that instead of looking at the overall, the DPP's officer, and it's important to stress that the DPP is not a single person who is so sagacious that they are the be-all and end-all of jurisprudence. It's a case of dishing out the files down to desks around the place. It went to this particular individual, who's no longer in the state, by the way, and who also took an action themselves against the DPP's office. Let's just park all of that from a legal point of view. But it seems to me that this person looked at every single piece of individual evidence and decided that that piece wasn't beyond all reasonable doubt. So it all got thrown onto the scrap heap. Whereas it seems more reasonable to me, and I would suggest the listener and the taxpayer, to assemble maybe 100 hurdles and run it in terms of circumstantial evidence, because there was no DNA, there was no forensics, as we know. Run it by an Irish jury of 12 people, not one, 12. And we'll find out where justice lies, because it cannot be said that Irish juries are prone to sending people down for condign punishment. We don't have that record in this country. If anything, you know,
he'd have got a fair trial.
Yeah, he would undoubtedly have got a fair trial. And I try and give him I try and see the points in his favour in the book. So the book is not a hit job. When somebody goes to the Gardaí and said, Ian Bailey told me that he actually worked, he did some gardening work for Sophie Tuscan de Plantier, I look at that as, you know, as also being, you know, very much fitting with his character. He was a bragger. That might not be true. It might just be something he said, you know. So I'm not just relying on every little last straw that people said about Ian Bailey. But there's no doubt, I mean, whoever killed Sophie Tuscan de Plantier was marked and cut and scraped themselves, because the pathologist said that as a result of the damage.
But sorry, didn't he have the damage inflicted by chickens that he was slaughtering for Christmas?
That's right, yeah. Well, he was actually,
it wasn't just
a chicken, yeah, he had upgraded it to a single turkey, which managed to viciously swipe out and create a deep injury on his forehead, which was then also explained by a stick. he didn't say branch, he said a stick. To my mind, a branch sticks out, but a stick is just lying on the ground. Then we had Christmas trees and so on. Your readers may not know that the Gardaí secured the actual Bailey Christmas tree that summer. They identified what it was.
That.
Yeah, and they had all the branches and so on. And a nice, wavy, simple Christmas tree. And they also commissioned forestry tests. I don't know if you've read the book, but...
not yet. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, they commissioned forestry tests, involving workers who didn't know anything to cut down the exact same type of tree. And in fact, a Garda Kevin Kelleher climbed the exact tree that had been cut down. He got to the top and came down and they photographed. He submitted his hands for being photographed, no damage. He climbed the next tree alongside that had not been cut. It was in the plantation, so there were plenty of trees and Bailey was getting his tree on the cheek.
Okay, let's move on or we won't see the wood from the trees, so to speak. How did you get interested in this?
Well, I was sent down there, so I was the first national crime correspondent on the scene as it happened. It happened over Christmas, so I actually, wasn't really looking forward to it because I'm based in Dublin and it was going to be a long haul to the end of the Mizzen Peninsula, essentially. It was going to be 5.5 hours to go down there, so I was... So I was cursing my luck at this having happened at all, and had a vague description that we were going to meet our local stringer down there, a guy called Owen Bailey, because he was being more Irish than the Irish themselves at that time. And
were working for the Star.
I was working for the Star, yeah.
And he was working as a stringer for the Star, and he was working as a stringer for the business pages of the Sunday Tribune,
yes,
which I was the editor of at the time. And he offered himself, given that he was on the ground, to cover the story for us as it happened as well.
Yes, and he did. And,
yeah.
And in fact, I itemise throughout the coverage, both for the Star and for the Sunday Tribune, how Ian Bailey knew things that had not been publicly released by the Gardaí, that he was ahead of the forensic findings. For instance, he reported, would you believe, on St. Stephen's Day, that the victim had not been sexually assaulted. Now, how on earth did he know that?
He hadn't been tipped off by the Gardaí. You know, as a journalist, lots of times journalists talk to the Gardaí, talk to people involved in the SGA, and they get quietly told, well, don't attribute it, don't say it officially, but here's what you can say.
Sure, but the pathologist who had carried out the post-mortem only the previous day on Christmas Eve himself didn't know, because in the nature of these things, he was taking swabs and sending them away for forensic analysis. And in fact, 2 weeks after Bailey reported that she was not sexually assaulted, the Irish Times said that the sexual assault swabs and tests were still awaited. So that was replicated time and time and time again in Bailey's case. And then I was shocked at how much amazing detail he had. I completely believe that he had the entire trust of several senior Gardaí. So when I got down there and he had given me this incredible bull run of information and detail about the crime as we were driving to the scene with my photographer in the Star, Martin Marr, he was telling about the times the lights went off in the house, how the body had one boot.
And what did you think at the time?
I thought this was the best ever fill of copy that I've ever had. The richest seam of sheer detail about two wine glasses upturned on the draining board. He had everything. So I thought this man was greatest journalist in the history of
creation. And what stage did you just start suspecting, hang on a second, could he be the one who did it?
Well, I started finding his behaviour really strange on that trip and subsequently. Just very perplexing. I couldn't understand at one level how he was so detached about this vicious crime in the locality. And I was saying to him, come on, you said to me you were thinking of going back into journalism and you'd been filing a couple of things about a branch closure of an AIB, to the Sunday Tribune. He actually filed, on the day the body was discovered, he filed a story about how certain pubs in West Cork were hooking up to the internet, to the Sunday Tribune. I mean, he seemed just to be a master of his craft, and I was in complete awe, and I thought myself very humble indeed if I had harboured any ambitions of making it in this great game of journalism. But then slowly I began to be being perplexed, turned into being puzzled and turned into suspicion, I'm afraid. And then when he was actually arrested, the scales fell from my eyes like a stage curtain with a huge crash.
Okay, and what about the conduct of the Garda investigation, though? I presume that's a big part of the book, which I'm really looking forward to, because the perception I would have is that they made an absolute and utter hames of it, which is the reason why he was never charged, apart from the DPP as well. And there would be many people who believe that in their enthusiasm to get the conviction, they cut corners.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that at all because, I mean, if you look at the book sets out how it led to an arrest. It was a long time after the arrest. Bailey himself reported on the 29th of December, 6 days after the killing, that an arrest is expected today. That was in your own paper when you were editing.
I remember.
You were editing the Sunday Tribune. And that didn't happen. He was only arrested on the 10th of February. Well, what had happened in the meantime? As I said, the pathologist had told the Gardaí that this woman fought very hard for her life. That was in his report. The Gardaí subsequently made an appeal for people to give information on anybody who was cut or scarred or marked in any way. And there were 18 informants who came forward separately and together, and they offered a name. And there was no other name. And we know that Ian Bailey had been helpfully playing the bow on in the pub on the night of the murder with his sleeves rolled up. And there were plenty of people there, and the Gardaí established the wattage of the bulbs on all of that. And next thing you know, Ian Bailey was starting to make admissions, which he covered by sometimes by saying it was black humour and so on. And he had lied on his questionnaire, as to where he had been. So he said he was in an entirely different place, both on the Saturday night and the Sunday night. Meanwhile, other people were filling in questionnaires and pinpointing exactly where he was. So there were
people who made claims who subsequently withdrew the claims, and their evidence was contradicted. I would know Jim Sheridan well, the movie maker, and he's made a TV documentary previously on this. And he had been working on a new sort of project, sort of dramatisation of it. But having spoken to Jim earlier in the year, he was absolutely convinced that Ian Bailey was innocent. And he spoke of some other foreign person who had come to West Cork and had escaped the country, and that should be the chief suspect.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. So let's look again at the crime signature, because Bailey actually asked me, come on, you're the crime journalist, what do you think? And I summed it up from very quickly. I said, look at what's happened here. This woman has been killed by 50 blows from a concrete block, a 12-pound concrete block that a powerful person has to pick up and wield. That can only be a man. Because it's a concrete block that's been ripped out of a pump house that was across the driveway from where the body was found, and because a stone was used, these were implements of opportunity. So therefore, it wasn't premeditated.
It wasn't somebody come from France and who had planned their subsequent departure.
Have you ever seen somebody putting a concrete block in the overhead bin of an aircraft? I haven't, you know. And you would make sure if you were... And by the way, this place is also impossible to find. I don't know if you've ever been there.
It was in the days before Google Maps.
Yeah. So the assassin sent in Day of the Jackal style from France would have to stop and ask for directions in his drowsy French accent and so on. And, you know, I know Jim is entitled... It's a free country. In fact, here's the thing. The Bailey case... ironically proves just how free a country this place is. So people are entitled to come to their... I would suggest humbly that Jim is maybe Johnny come lately to the story.
Well, you've been there since the start, and you have put everything together comprehensively, and you're not afraid to call it as you see it. Sophie, the final verdict, Senna Maloney, thank you so much for joining us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.